Okay, everyone. Sorry about that. So this podcast will today, just for today, will be in two parts. What happened was I dropped my mic and it came unhooked and it stopped the recording. So you're going to get this podcast in two parts today. Sorry about that. So, as I was saying, that was Elizabeth Warren's campaign ad, and it was okay. You know, it's not completely bad, and it wasn't quite as cliched and just vague and platitudinous as most campaigns are, but it was still, but there were still some platitudes and cliches in there, and I don't, you know, I enjoy hearing about people's backgrounds when they're campaigning. I really do, but I don't think, or at least I like hearing politicians' backgrounds, but I don't think it's appropriate, I guess, or necessary. That's a better word. Necessary in a campaign video, because you have to get specific, and Warren, to her credit, did lay out some specific policies, like she's gonna continue the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to protect Americans from fraudulent business practices and corporations stealing their money. So that was good. That was pretty good. That was a fairly specific policy, but the whole thing was that my problem with it was she says things like, again, these vague things like, oh, we have to make it so the government in America works for us and all of us, or, you know, something to that effect. What does that mean? You know, it's like, and notice how she didn't mention things like Medicare for All, New Deal. She didn't mention any of those policies. So again, that's why I said that she was better. This was certainly better and more policy focused than the usual campaign videos tend to be. But considering they set the bar pretty low already, she's not going to get a lot of praise from me. It's like, I don't really care about what your background is. I care about what you're going to do for this country and for the people of this country that are hurting. And when you say that, oh, we need to give people more opportunity and we need to do this and we need to make sure the government works for all people. And what does any of that stuff mean? You know, like that. So it's like, the thing with Elizabeth Warren is, yes, her heart is in the right place, but she has one foot in the corporate Democrat camp, which is Schumer, Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, that wing of the party. And she does have one foot in the more Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ro Khanna, Bernie Sanders wing. And it's really sad to see her, because she, I agree with Kyle Kulinski, she gets into this mindset of, I got to listen to what my strategists tell me to do. How about this, Senator Warren? No strategists. You don't need a Democratic strategist to help you. They are the stupidest people on the face of the earth, Democratic strategists. You are a smart, intelligent, capable woman. You should be able to run this campaign on your own, because you know what the people really want, and you deep down know that you shouldn't be a corporate Democratic shill, as you've recently become in the past couple of years. So, and just so everybody knows, Elizabeth Warren was a Republican until the mid-90s. So, it's just, it's insane. So, that really scares me, because I think that, you know, I fear that that means that if she gets elected president, she's just going to cave to the Republicans like the Democrats tend to do, as I've made very clear on this podcast. So overall, Liz, good job, but you got to get more policy specific. You got to stop it with the anecdotes and the platitudes and the cliches and the word salad. You know, just say what you're for. Boom, 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 boom. I want Medicare for all. I want to cap the interest rates that colleges can charge. I want to increase the capital gains tax. I want to do a new deal that would provide newer and better infrastructure and more jobs to Americans, and it will be a benefit to this entire country. You got to stick to that stuff, you know. So that's what I would say to that. Let's get to the news. So first item is from an article in Paste, which is normally a music and culture magazine, but they do write about politics as well. So the article title is Nancy Pelosi is pushing a pay-go provision despite objections from progressives, and this was written by Josh Hilgenberg. So let's see what he has to say here. Nancy Pelosi is fighting for the 116th Congress. 116th Congress rules to include a pay-as-you-go provision, despite progressives urging her not to. The pay-as-you-go provision, or PAYGO, was initially a conservative strategy used to hold government captive by requiring that all new spending must be offset by budget cuts or tax increases. A spokesperson for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez told The Intercept that she would oppose, and Representative Ro Khanna said himself on Wednesday that he would also vote against it, drawing a hold line between Democrats and the presumptive House Speaker. Progressives hate this bill because if it passes, it will not only become more difficult to pass global quality of life bills such as Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, and tuition-free college, but Republicans will also be able to mutilate the tax code in their favor. Yet Pelosi, who will be sworn in as Speaker of the House on Thursday, wants to push the PAYGO bill into play. The light in which this paints Democrats won't be good either, especially against an opponent that preaches tax cuts. Liberal Democrats present new legislation that makes life better for as many people as possible. Because of PAYGO, they'll likely have to raise taxes. Republicans will point to Democrats as taking advantage of taxpayer funds and appeal to voters who care more about their wallets than their neighbors. However, even after the midterms, Republicans will still control the White House and the Senate, meaning big-ticket Democratic items won't pass anyway. Communications Director for Justice Democrats, Waleed Shaheed, told The Intercept, there's an enormous appetite in the Democratic Party and among all Americans for major public investment to tackle our nation's major crises, deepening inequality and structural racism and climate disaster. Pelosi and the Democratic Party leadership's support of PAYGO makes actually solving these crises all but impossible. The Democratic leadership is unilaterally disarming and shooting themselves in the foot. And then they go on to highlight the positives and you know, basically what they do is, in the positive realm, is they are the Democrats are going to reinstate the Gephardt rule, meaning the past budget resolutions will automatically allow the national debt to increase as necessary. So, okay. But this is a really important story because it highlights that Nancy Pelosi, she isn't nearly as quote-unquote left-wing as certain people make her out to be. You know, it's just so weird that people, it's so wrong that people perceive her as this unabashed, hardline leftist when you can see right here, all she does is pretend to resist the Republicans, and then when nobody's looking, you give the Republicans everything they want. That's what Nancy Pelosi does. That is her in a nutshell. You know, so she's taking a Republican plan to, you know, she's adopting a Republican strategy to intentionally handicap and mutilate, as Hilgenberg said, and mutilate the progressive agenda. You know, so the fact that people think that Nancy Pelosi, like Charlie Kirk was saying that, oh, you know, it's scary to think that some people think she's a moderate. Charlie, you should love Nancy Pelosi. She loves tax cuts. She loves Wall Street. She loves corporations. You know, this is what Nancy Pelosi lives for. So Nancy Pelosi lives to please her corporate donors and the Republicans. So this is just infuriating because it shows that the Democratic Party really is a center-right entity, you know, because they don't care, and they're also establishment. You know, it would be okay if they were like center-right and populist, but no, they're center-right and establishment. All they care about is serving the establishment. Even when the majority of the people who put the Democrats there, who elect these Democrats in the first place, they support things like Medicare for All, free college. Even Republicans, a growing number of Republicans support these policies. And somebody with a ton of sway in the government, like Nancy Pelosi, just shoots that down and stabs progressives in the back and stabs populists in the back. So this is just infuriating, and I hope that these progressive ideas, which this country desperately needs and can thrive on and prosper from, I hope that those ideas can overcome this absolutely abhorrent, terrible strategy from Nancy Pelosi, who is just crazy and senile and totally corrupt and should never have gotten anywhere near power. But here we are in 2019. She is in power. She wields a lot of it, and that is the scary part. So anyway, let's move on. This is from the WSWS. And this is France's yellow vest protests and the fraud of Mélenchon's citizens' revolution. And this was written by Alex Lantier. So he writes, the yellow vest protest in France and strikes organized on social media in Portugal have unmasked the petty bourgeois milieu of union bureaucrats and official quote-unquote left parties in Europe. The eruption of a movement in the working class against social inequality blindsided them, busy as they were promoting austerity and war in the presidential palaces and parliamentary speeches, having played no role whatsoever in the movement against French President Emmanuel Macron. They are now trying to strangle it. The left bloc, or the BE, the Portuguese allies of Jean-Luc Mélenchon's unsubmissive France, which is LFI, that's his party, does not hide its fear and loathing towards strikers and yellow vests. BE official Francisco Lucha denounced them. This is a far-right operation. They are using social media to whip up aggressive politicization in far-right terms. Mélenchon, however, tries to influence the yellow vests, pompously declaring they have vindicated his populism. On his blog, he writes, "I am jubilant. Current events are, I believe, the confirmation of the theoretical model formulated in my theory of citizens' revolutions, summarized in my book, The Era of the People." Sorry about that. If Mélenchon claims victory in the vapid realm of postmodernist theory, here's that term again, it is because, for him, the Yellow Vest movement is, in reality, a defeat. The class struggle erupted when the Yellow Vests, including thousands of Mélenchon voters, took action independently of the LFI. Masses of workers in France and internationally have received a priceless lesson. The real struggle against the ruling elite requires opposing the anti-Marxist forces that for decades have masqueraded as the left. Mélenchon's populist theory of citizens' revolution serves only to block the revolutionary struggle against inequality, joblessness, and war demanded by the Yellow Vests while denouncing Marxism and socialism. Discussing the era of the people, Mélenchon declares, "In all cases, my work does not say how the regime could fall under the blows of such a movement. All the more so because, in my view, the result must be peaceful and democratic. That is to say, in all cases, we must find an institutional solution to events." And they just go through the history of European working class movements. It's a pretty long article, so I'll just stop there. But first of all, I want to say that I totally support, obviously, the Yellow Vest protesters. And to Mélenchon's point is, oh, it was a far-right thing. Well, no, actual lefties in France protested as well, so that's a bullshit dodge. And also, I don't care that some far-right people participated along with the lefty people. Great. That's great. The more people, you know, the more the merrier. The more support that this movement can get, the better. And I don't care if it comes from far-right people. I really don't. It doesn't matter to me at all. At all. So, it's just weird. That's just a weird thing. And also, so he claims to be a leftist, but he opposes socialism and Marxism. Yeah, great strategy. You know, very good strategy. And then he says, we have to find institutional solutions to this. No, screw your institutions. Shove them up your ass, you elitist prick. Like, what is you? This just goes to show you that left-wing parties, especially in America, but also in Europe, are full of shit. They don't care about leftism at all. At all. They only care about being slightly less right-wing than their right-wing, actual right-wing counterparts. So this is just infuriating to me. And I hope that people in Europe will finally continue to wake up and realize that these so-called left-wing parties aren't going to help you. And these institutions are not going to help you. These institutions need to be shut down. Peaceful, yes. If we can do it peacefully, that would be great. But something tells me that even though I don't advocate for violent revolution, which is another one of my disagreements with Marx, he seemed to say, yeah, violence, let's do that. No, I think what we need to do is we either need to elect people with a real leftist agenda in, or if we try, let's say strikes, there's strikes in certain industries. If the owners rebel or try to quell the rebellion and shoot, try to use police force to shoot down literally protesters, then yes, you can fight back, but don't initiate violence. You know, don't do that. You know, that's totally unconscionable. It's not an effective strategy or a moral one. So you either need to elect actual democratic socialists, or you need to start staging mass strikes like they have been doing. And this also, and then you need to just react accordingly. But anyway, this flies in the face of this notion that these unions are somehow these ultra-lefty liberal organizations. Liberal, probably, but lefty? No way. They're just government-appointed bureaucrats, as this article outlines. So, France, workers of France, I should say, keep doing what you're doing. Keep protesting, no matter if you're left, right, whatever. Just keep fighting the good fight, if you will. All right. Next. So, this next article comes from UT. Or, UT. That's funny. RT. And it is... Now, I've never used RT as a source on this podcast before, but I do like RT a lot. I used TASS before, but not RT. But yeah, it's really good. So anyway, the article title is UNESCO's Turn: Washington and Tel Aviv Ditch International Body Over, quote, anti-Israel bias. Oh, here we go again. So the Israel-Palestine thing is also something that I've never talked about really in great detail on my YouTube channel, and I've never discussed here on this podcast, so let me discuss it today. Okay. So, the U.S., followed by Israel, has left UNESCO, citing a pro-Palestinian bias allegedly persisting within the agency. Recently, Washington has been eager to ditch any institutions and deals which supposedly harm its interests. This decision of the U.S. took effect late Monday, closely followed by Tel Aviv, which kicked in on the first day of 2019. The withdrawal of U.S. and Israel from UNESCO is hardly surprising, as both have had long-standing tensions with the agency. Washington's move was made public in October 2017 when it announced the withdrawal, citing concerns with mounting arrears at UNESCO, the need for fundamental reform in the organization, and continuing anti-Israel bias at UNESCO. A similar evaluation was produced by Israeli officials, who have repeatedly made accusations against the UN cultural body. It is corrupted and manipulated by Israel's enemies and continually singles out the only Jewish state for condemnation. We are not going to be a member of an organization that deliberately acts against us. Israeli ambassador to the UN, Danny Dannon, told the Times of Israel on Monday. leaving any international organization that does not serve the U.S. and often Israel's interests appears to be a trend in Washington under the Trump administration. In May 2018, President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the landmark Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action agreement with Iran, citing flaws in the deal and opening the way to imposing sanctions. Will the move alarmed European nations, which tried and failed to stop the U.S. from leaving the agreement, the decision was enthusiastically hailed by top Israeli officials. Oh, gee, I wonder why. So, in June 2018, the U.S. also pulled out of the United Nations Human Rights Council, with them ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley branding it a hypocritical and self-serving organization that displays unending hostility towards Israel, while the UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad al-Hussein described the U.S.'s withdrawal as disappointing, if not really surprising news. The decision was launched again. The decision was again lauded by Tel Aviv. The decision to leave UNESCO, as well as other international bodies, is likely to be reversed after Trump leaves office. Former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia Peter Galbraith told RT, expressing doubts over the president's re-election in 2020. This is an entirely political step. It has to be pointed out that the irony of it is that these institutions, the United States, the International Court of Justice, the Human Rights Council, were created by the United States, or the United States took the lead and now they withdraw. So far, the Trump administration has expressed a willingness to stay engaged at UNESCO as a non-member observer state. However, it remains a question whether Trump's move to withdraw is only a temporary one, as it is actually in line with the policies of his predecessors. In 2011, both the U.S. and Israel stopped paying their dues at UNESCO after Palestine was voted in as a member state. In 2013, Washington and Tel Aviv were stripped of their voting rights over unpaid dues. So, my gosh, a lot to unpack there. So, first, let me just tell you guys what the UNESCO actually is. So, the UNESCO is a cultural organization by the UN, or under the UN, and it stands for the United States Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. So, to the idea that the United Nations has this anti-Israel bias, it's just absurd. It's total nonsense. And it just, this is what really gets at me about their claims that the institution is biased. Israel's claims that the institution is biased against them. You guys are occupying the Palestinian territory. Now, I know there's a million different caveats and dodges that you guys use, but you are occupying, illegally occupying territory that's not yours under international law. And yes, Palestine is not a state officially, but it should be. So, the reason why the UN is hounding your asses is not because they're anti-Semitic and they have this anti-Israel bias. No, it's because you guys are denying the human rights of Palestinians. So, and then when you say that, some people go, oh, you're saying that Israel doesn't have a right to defend itself. Of course Israel has a right to defend itself. I'm not saying that it doesn't. Nobody I know is saying that it does. I haven't heard anybody say Israel doesn't have a right to defend itself. But you guys obviously don't think that Palestinians have a right to defend themselves. Yes, when Hamas goes and does something crazy, like recently they fired rockets into Israel because there was some Israeli intelligence official or something showed up in a car on the Palestinian border and they murdered him or something like that. Yeah, that's really stupid. They're like, it's encroachment. You know, that's really stupid. And I think that the Palestinian people should condemn that behavior and that action on the part of Hamas and 90% of the other stuff that Hamas does. But still, that begs the question. So are you saying that Israel does have a right to defend itself, but when Israel does something stupid, Palestine does not have a right to defend itself? You know, that's really the only conclusion that I can draw from this. So that's the reason. So the reason why the UN is tough on Israel, or tougher, I should say, because it's not even true that they have this obsession with Israel. The UN has this obsession with it. It's like, have you seen those graphs where they're like, there's a bunch of different words, and based on how many times the word was mentioned or somebody was in favor of a certain word or whatever, it gets bigger. Israel isn't even on that chart. Israel doesn't even chart. You know, Sudan was on there, North Korea was on there. You know, so this idea that there's this like systematic conspiracy at the UN that just wants to pick on Israel and destroy it or whatever is just patently absurd. And the United Nations was responsible for Israel even coming into existence. You know, yes, they got a lot of help from the United States, but the United States, at least for now, is still part of the United Nations and was one of the leading countries behind that institution in the first place. So what are you talking about, anti-Israel bias? That's just, it's insane. And I agree with this article that, you know, these people in the Trump administration, they don't have any respect for, and especially Trump himself, they don't have any respect for agreements that are even 1% in the, you know, 1% not in the interest of the United States. It has to be 100% in service of the interests of the United States, and we get to do whatever we have to be able to do whatever we want, or we're just going to pull out of it like children. When you don't get your way, just pull out of something. Yeah, that's what 6-year-olds do. Not grown men, you know. So it's like, which is why I agree with people that we basically have a man-child in the White House. So that's always fun. But so no, Israel is not persecuted by the UN. The US needs to negotiate with people instead of just unilaterally pulling out of every agreement we've ever made. So that does it for that story. All right. Last story. This is, sorry about that. This is from The Hill. And it says, pro-business Dem group hits record membership. Oh, that's lovely. and this was from, this was written all the way back a couple weeks ago. So this was written by Alex Gangitano. Okay. So he says, the new Democrat coalition will have a record number of members in the next Congress, strengthening the party's pro-business group's relationship with K Street. I don't necessarily know what that means. strengthening the group of K Street at a time when the party's far left lawmakers want to cut ties with corporations. The New Democrats are slated to have about 90 lawmakers in their ranks when the party takes control of the House next month, but their ascent is likely to create tension with lawmakers at the other end of the Democrats' political spectrum. K Street has maintained close relationships, same thing, with members of the fiscally conservative coalition formed in 1997, with lawmakers regularly sitting down with CEOs and representatives from think tanks to discuss policy ideas and proposals. New Dems are the ones who will get things done, as opposed to the progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a consultant told The Hill, referring to the recently elected New York Democrat, adding that the coalition is committed to the small bipartisan policy victories. Lobbyists say they look to the New Democrats as a kind of window into the Democratic Party. It's not, let's just go to the New Dems because they will agree with what we want to do, a lobbyist said. They know enough about business and the economy to know what's real and what's bullshit. The lawmakers engaging in those policy debates are folks like Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut, the group's outgoing chairman, and his successor, Representative Derek Kilmer of Washington. We are laser-focused on growing the pie, creating jobs in every part of the country, and building an economy where businesses innovate and create more economic opportunities for more people in more places, Kilmer said in the statement. Members of the coalition who are slated to be in leadership for the 116th Congress include, include Representative Sherry Bustos of Illinois, who will be the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, chairwoman, and Representative-elect Katie Hill of California, a freshman caucus representative. New Democrats will reach across the aisle in both the House and the Senate on priorities like reducing the cost of health care, making Congress work better through House rules reform, ethics reform, and campaign finance reform, and investing in American infrastructure, the group's spokesperson said. This is a really long article, and my voice is getting tired, so I'm just going to... I think you can get the idea. And they talk about how, ooh, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has refused to accept PAC donations. You know, as if it's like absurd that she does that. Like, ooh, she's not taking PAC money. What's wrong with her? This is what's wrong with establishment outlets like The Hill and establishment organizations like the DCCC and the New Democratic Coalition, which is basically New Democrat, neoliberal, which basically means Democrats that are just going to cave to the Republicans all the time. That's what that means. So, or at least 90% of the time. So, and that's what all that bipartisan bullshit was about. Like, oh, we care about being bipartisan and reaching across the aisle. Yeah, shut up. Shut up. You know, bipartisanship is not inherently good. Bipartisanship, most of the time, is bullshit. These are people that are screwing people. You know, when bipartisanship when you hear that word bipartisanship, that shouldn't excite you. That should terrify you, because 9 times out of 10, when you hear bipartisanship, that means the Democrats and the Republicans have just agreed to screw you over and make your life worse. That's what bipartisanship is. So it's just, and on like really, really far right legislation, a bipartisan thing, like, let's take healthcare. The Republicans, most of them, want insurance companies to be the only ones really in charge. The Democrats want basically Obamacare. They love Obamacare because that also still keeps the private health insurance companies in place. So if you have a cross between Obamacare and a totally laissez-faire free market capitalist healthcare plan, you basically get Trump care. That's what bipartisanship gets you. You know, bipartisanship gets you military budget increases. Like, even Elizabeth Warren voted for Trump's spending increase, military spending. So this whole bipartisanship thing that the media tries to push, and Fox News tries to push, and the thing that, you know, people that aren't necessarily engaged a lot with politics, this is something I'd expect all of them to say, like, oh, why can't the Republicans and Democrats just get along? Well, first of all, they do a lot more often than it's presented as. Second of all, when they get along, it's usually really sad and bad for like 99.9% of people in this country. So this is just insane. It's another way to just kick progressives in the teeth. On top of yeah, great. There's more people in the new Democratic coalition than ever. That's great. And it's funny how they call Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez far left. that's a laugh. That really is a laugh. Unbelievable. And they this article has this tone of like I said, like, oh, she doesn't accept corporate PAC money, you know? And she criticizes pay-to-play politics at both the local and federal level. Oh my God, so far left. You know, it's like, no, that's reasonable. That's just reasonable. That's not far left. What are you talking about? You know, that's a fairly milquetoast, actually, position, or should be the milquetoast position. But of course, The Hill, being an establishment outlet, it has to frame things in an unbelievably establishment biased way, which helps to, again, serve corporate interests and preserve the two-party duopoly and basically the two-party dictatorship just advance corporate interests and the interests of the political and economic elites. So that wraps it up for me today. Like I said, this podcast will be in two parts. It's my fault. I'm sorry. My mic literally dropped and stopped recording. So this podcast will be in two parts, and I will try to get my podcast in all in one go next time. Next time when I see and speak with you guys again. So thank you for tuning into the Left Side of Liberty podcast. I'm Jordan Jardine, and I will see you guys next week.